This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the podcast for Wednesday, the 27th of February, for Woman's Hour. Now, Tom Kerridge is a Michelin-starred chef who famously lost 12 stones by changing his lifestyle. Today, he cooks the perfect roasted winter sprout curry from his book Fresh Start. The recruitment of gay and lesbian adoptive parents in Scotland. Why is the campaign being promoted in nightclubs? And getting a business started if you're a black, Asian or minority ethnic woman. How difficult is it to find investment? Now, it's not unusual to hear about girls and young women who suffer from an eating disorder, whether it be anorexia or bulimia. It's rare to hear about a boy or a young man, but the number of boys receiving treatment has doubled in recent years. Since 2012, the number of boys going to hospital in England, Scotland and Wales increased from 235 to 466. Professor Sandeep Ranaut is a consultant child and adolescent psychiatrist at North West Boroughs Healthcare NHS Foundation Trust and joins us from Salford. Samuel Pollan is the author of The Year I Didn't Eat, a novel for teenagers about a boy with anorexia. Samuel became anorexic when he was 12. So why did he decide to write a novel for other young people?
It's quite simple, really. It was something that I wish had existed when I was going through an eating disorder. It can be very hard to relate to a factual story, I think. Certainly when I was going through it, I sort of dismissed any story that was factual as, well, that's someone else. It's not my experience. It's different to me. So by writing a novel, I was able to kind of draw in a range of experiences and kind of help people understand a little about the thought processes and kind of what you go through.
Sandeep, what other books would you say might help both parents and young people who might be going through this themselves?
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Sam. It's really great to meet you. A brilliant book, and what I would say is The Power of Story is such a powerful resource that we haven't harnessed enough of. So thank you for sharing your story in a book. The article in The Times was fantastic. I hope you don't mind me mentioning a couple of other books that people might find helpful.
That's great.
Particularly if you're a male or a young male. So one of them is Weight Expectations by Dave Chawner. You may have heard of that one. And he also writes about his recovery from anorexia. And I think that hope and the story of hope for other people and for families and friends and loved ones is so important in terms of how to get help, how to get treatment, how to get support, because it is available, it is out there. One of the things, could I just read one sentence from Weight Expectations, because I think people will find it helpful. When I was going through the anorexia, one of the worst things was that people began to treat me differently, like something fragile that might break at any point. That was proper isolating. And I think that's really key. This is real illness, and the people who are going through it are still people. They're people. And that's really important. There's another book that's not written by somebody from the UK. But of course, that's important because you can get an eating disorder whoever you are and wherever you are around the world. It's called The Incredible Jake Parker by Angelo Thomas. So look out for that one as well. particularly potentially appealing to younger males.
Now, Sam, you were 12 when this happened. I know you suffered for 2 years. How did you realise that you had an eating disorder?
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to sort of discover. It kind of builds up over time, and then before you know it, it's happening. A kind of strange thing about eating disorders is that you have very rational thoughts and very kind of normal thoughts about it, as well as your sort of delusional thoughts that kind of come from the eating disorder. So I sort of kind of realised over time, as the behaviours sort of built up, and as I was confronted with the fact that I'd lost a huge amount of weight, and I got ill. The kind of key moment was I got the flu, and I was too weak to go into the doctors or to go upstairs to go to bed. So we had to have a call out doctor, and that was the sort of moment where it was like you realised how much had happened.
But I mean, you called this book The Year I Didn't Eat, which is a very literal thing to say. Was there a year where you didn't eat?
I mean, it's a title that kind of draws people into the idea of this whole year being dominated by food, and that being the thing that Max, the character, thinks about the whole time. No, I was eating, but I was eating less and less as time went on.
And how did your parents deal with it?
They were, I should say I was 12 years old, so I probably didn't, fully understand what they were going through and kind of the conversations they were having, but they were hugely supportive. I think Sandeep mentioned something really important there about treating people differently. What they did that ended up being very important for me was carrying on family routines, carrying on, we still went and visited my grandparents and we still played board games together, such that not every conversation I was having was about my food, about my weight. And that kind of, because habits are so important to eating disorders, and they're also really important to breaking them, and that idea of having a kind of normal life that I could slip back into, my parents did an amazing job, for which I am very grateful, making that the case.
Sandeep, this rise in the number of boys being treated, and this assumption that we've always had for such a long time that this is only something that affects girls, why are we seeing it now more and more in boys?
Great question. Not one that I'm going to have an easy answer for. I think, like many things, it's a mixture of reasons, and a mixture of reasons why we're now, thankfully, seeing more boys accessing help, support and treatment, whereas before we weren't seeing as many. And I speak both as a professional and as a parent. I have three boys between the ages of 11 and 17. So it's so important to me that you're covering this issue and that people are starting to speak out. I think one of the reasons we are seeing more boys is that barriers are being broken down, stigma is being reduced, people are starting to talk about not just eating disorders, but a whole range of mental health conditions and mental illnesses. There's better awareness, better screening, and therefore, because of that, it has enabled and empowered young males and boys and families to seek that help where they may not have done before because of the stigma, because of shame, because it was seen as a more acceptable illness for young women and females to have. So on one hand, it is good that we're seeing more boys accessing help. On the other hand, we do need to understand better. It's a mix, and there are a mixture of reasons why people get eating disorders.
That was going to be my next question. What do we know about what causes them?
So, it's a mixture of things. These are neurobiological illnesses. They are real illnesses, just like diabetes, epilepsy and asthma. We know that genetic factors are involved. We know that environmental factors may be involved and social factors. Certain personality types are at a higher risk. Sam mentioned, it's about habits and worrying. So people who are naturally more anxious or worriers or perfectionistic are at a higher risk or more sensitive. We know that we're living in a different time. Our young people today are influenced by different things to what we may have been 20 and 30 years ago. That said, this is a neurobiological illness. So it's about what increases risks. People talk about social media a lot, and I get asked that question a lot. I'm sure Sam does. We don't have a linkage or a cause, but we know that certainly there is an impact, and that for those people at a risk of developing an eating disorder, it can exacerbate or make things worse. Equally, there are positives about social media. body image and role models. Young males now are under pressures that potentially they weren't under decades ago, to look a certain way and be a certain way, particularly around physical health and exercise and kind of, you know, the perfect body. So there are a mixture of reasons why the pressure boys are under now is different to before.
Sam, your message is to get help as soon as you possibly can. And Max, in the novel, learns about group sessions. What does he learn from that?
Yeah, well, he actually learns his own experience. He's kind of reading about them online, and his own experience is very isolated. I felt that was what I wanted to write about, because that was my own experience. I didn't know other people that were going through eating disorders when I was going through one. But absolutely, other people, that kind of understanding that other people are going through it and have gone through it, I think is a really important thing for people. I know that some people get a lot of succour and comfort from talking to other people who are going through it, and that's become one of the, talking about positive sides of social media, that's become much easier to connect with other people who have had the experience.
Sandy, Sam's character lists some horrific things that can go wrong in his body, and we know this is a serious condition which can kill. What would you say to anybody who's listening to this programme, who's concerned either about themselves or about their child?
What I would say is, lots of what we've said already is, think about if you were worried about your daughter or your son having diabetes, for instance, what would you do? Do not suffer alone. Do not suffer in silence. It's so important to speak to someone you trust, to go and access help from your GP, or indeed, we have fantastic organisations like BEAT, the National Eating Disorder Association charity, that have helplines and support lines that can guide you guide you to get that early help as soon as possible. We have the NHS websites. The important thing is to speak to somebody. We're doing so much more work with schools where young people spend most of their time. So you can also access that information and advice through schools. But the key is speak to somebody, because you can get help.
And Sam, you're much older now, obviously. How are you around food now?
I'm fine around food. You know, everyone has some peculiarities around food, I think, and that's definitely true of me today. But one thing that I really wanted to capture in the book is that, and one thing that seemed kind of baffling and so unlikely to me when I was going through an eating disorder, is that you could recover completely and have a normal relationship with food, where you go out for dinner and you eat whatever you want at home, and you don't really think about it too much day to day. And that's been the case for me nearly two decades now, and I think that's really important. You know, although it's tragically a lot of people do continue to struggle for years or decades, or in their eating disorders don't go away, lots of people do, and I think that's a really important thing to hear if you're going through it.
Samuel Pollan and Professor Sandeep Ranaut, thank you very much indeed, both of you, for being with us this morning. This will be next week's podcast for parents. You can download it and listen to it again, and really thank you both very much. We'd also like to hear from you if you're a parent of someone who has an eating disorder, or a young person with an eating disorder. Please let us know. Now, next week has been dubbed LGBT Adoption and Fostering Week, with the aim of encouraging more gay and lesbian couples and single people to adopt and foster children in need. There's been a rise of some 75% of children in Scotland in care away from home since 2004. An adoption society there has decided to try a new idea to encourage people to think about taking on a child. The St Andrews Children's Society, which is based in Edinburgh, is planning to target gay bars and clubs. Tor Doherty is the chief executive of New Family Social. Rita Grant is the adoption support manager at the St Andrews Children's Society and is in Edinburgh. Rita, why is there a shortage of LGBT people coming forward to adopt or foster when obviously the need is so great?
I know, Jenny, we often say that in our agency ourselves. I think that there are still some myths that need to be dispelled about gay and lesbian people becoming parents to children who need adoption. very often when we have people come to our agency for inquiries or to come on our preparation courses, they're quite taken aback at just how welcoming and delighted we are to have our gay and lesbian friends come in to look after children who cannot stay with their birth family. So we feel, and I know many people who are doing this kind of work, we feel very strongly about wanting to dispel some myths and invite our gay and lesbian friends to consider adoption. And I think what's very interesting, for the people who have come through our agency, they've often said to us, I never really thought we could become a mum or a dad. And in a sense, why not? You know, straight couples don't ask that question. And why should they have to ask that question?
Now, Tor, I know that you and your partner have two children, birth children, and then adopted a boy. What prompted that decision?
Hi. We had two children that we conceived through a clinic at a time when there were only three clinics in the country that would see a same-sex couple. And we gained a bit of confidence as parents. You know, when we first brought our son home, I didn't know how you changed a nappy or anything. I knew nothing. And so we gained confidence over the next couple of years. And by the time we were thinking, well, maybe there's room for a third child in our family, we thought maybe adoption was the way. And I sometimes would, you know, have a nice day with my children and think, there are some children who don't have this. They're not settled in the way that my children are. And I just started to think that maybe that third space in our family could be for a child who had already been born but who didn't have that certainty.
Now, Rita, it's been thought of in some areas as a little bit controversial that you're targeting clubs and bars. Why are you doing it that way?
I suppose we just thought we'd be a little bit different and go to where the gay and lesbian community congregate and meet. It's a relaxed and informal setting, and whilst we have had open evenings for LGBT people at our agency, we just thought, well, let's do something different. It's LGBT week. Why don't we come to them?
So how will you manage it? What will you actually do in the clubs or the bars to put forward your campaign?
Okay, well, we have a room booked, obviously, and we have a small presentation ready to share with the people who will attend. We also have some of our approved adopters. They're all gay men who are coming to the different venues to talk from their own experience of what it was like to be approved, what it was like to go through the process of home study, and indeed then to be linked and matched with their child or children. We feel it's always lovely for prospective adopters to hear from adopters who've gone through the process. They give it something very real and a real quality that no matter how great the social workers are, I think hearing it from the people who have gone through the process with our agency, it's just, there's something more real and authentic about that.
Tor, what was it like to go through the process of approval and then adopting your little boy?
I was nervous when we started phoning adoption agencies. I didn't know whether they would be welcoming to us or not. And I would have loved if somebody handed me a leaflet in a bar saying, you're welcome at our agency. We didn't have that. And so I cold called agencies to see who would want us, who would take us. I was so nervous that I thought the best thing to do was tell them everything bad up front, because I had a list of reasons in my mind why I thought we'd be rejected. So I just blurted all of those out, and included in that list was that we were a same-sex couple. I now know that adoption agencies want people whose life has had bumps in the road, because if your life has been very straightforward, that's lovely, but it means that you haven't really been tested against stress and maybe your relationship hasn't been through the mill a little bit. Whereas Jackie and I were able to say, you know, we've had this bump in the road, we've had this health problem and so on. And we were able to show that we've come through difficult times, and they were very, very welcoming of that.
And how does it work now? When you go out as a family, you and the three children, how do people regard you?
Generally fine. People don't ever assume that we're a family on site. So that's it's a shame, really. We're often asked who we all are to each other. We did once go into a pizza restaurant and the waiter said, are you guys a family? And we were like, yeah. And he went, oh, that's amazing. And then he came back and he said, you know what? It's on the house just to celebrate. And it was just such a lovely thing. I would have more adopted children if I thought I'd get more free pizza. But so it's it's fine and it's generally okay. We don't meet open hostility really at all. I know that some people do, but that thing of knowing that other families are doing it as well and having families to lean on is fantastic.
Tor Doherty and Rita Grant, thank you both very much indeed for being with us this morning. Now, still to come in today's programme, Tom Kerridge, now half the size of his former self, cooks the perfect roasted winter sprout curry from his book Fresh Start. And the serial, the third episode of Maya Angelou's A Song Flung Up to Heaven. Now, a podcast for parents is published today and it is available to download. It's about how you should introduce alcohol to your teenager, that is, if you're going to introduce it at all. You'll also find an article with tips about it on the Woman's Hour website. Now, don't forget you can subscribe to Woman's Hour on BBC Sounds. You may have missed a discussion earlier in the week about the sexual harassment of students and how they fail to report it, or a woman who is obsessed with wolves and follows them around the world and even likes to kiss them. You really don't want to miss that one. Now, anyone who's trying to set up a business needs some sort of financial backing. Venture capitalists are the people you go to if the bank, as is often the case, says no. But there's evidence that black, Asian and minority ethnic women who have a good idea and want to get started are having difficulty getting any kind of financial support through the usual routes. Why? Well, Charmaine Hayden is a senior partner at Good Soul Venture Capital. Mariam Jimo is the founder of the Woman in the City Afro-Caribbean Network, and she's an entrepreneur trying to raise funds for a new technology company. So how, Mariam, are you trying to set up a business, and what sort of business are you trying to set up?
So the business I'm trying to set up is a tech-enabled marketplace that would allow people to access international and ethnic groceries from across the UK. So pretty much London is kind of focused, a very multicultural hub.
So what, delivery?
Exactly.
You make the logistics, food and then deliver it?
Not necessarily make the foods, but utilise stores that already exist in the UK in different pockets of London and make that accessible across the UK. So if you're in Chelsea, you can still get foods that you may only be able to get in, say, Peckham. So that's kind of the concept. And that's what I'm building.
And how has the search for funding gone?
So I managed to do quite a small friends and family round. So I raised amongst people I knew. And then now I'm kind of looking for a pre-seed before I go into my
What's
seed
a
round.
Pre-seed? Come on, this is business, you have to explain.
Yeah. So a seed round would be something you need to kind of start your idea and get your idea off the ground. I guess a pre-seed would be something that you would need to sort of get to the point where you can do that. So some businesses are a bit more complicated, they need a little bit more funding. For me, it's my business is app-based, so development and so on and so forth you need some cash to get to the point where you could start.
So Charmaine, how does somebody like Mariam go to get the cash? Hello? Charmaine.
Hello.
Oh, hello. There you are.
Hiya.
I thought I'd lost you there. My question was, how does someone like Mariam, looking for cash to set up her business, go about it?
Well, in an ideal world, she'd just go and pitch to some angel investors or some venture capital firms. Otherwise, she'd raise the revenue organically through her company. But in reality, there are a number of challenges that she may face.
What sort of challenges?
Well, specifically, if you're looking at something that's focused on an ethnic group, it may be frowned upon because it may be looked at as a niche, even though, you know, the group is so large and the market cap, the number of people that it's potentially would potentially buy are huge. It's still kind of seen as a niche in the same way that Pinterest was initially kind of fobbed off because people thought, oh, it's just targeted at women. This isn't a problem. This isn't something that people care about. Let's not pay attention to it. And in fact, that's like one of the world's unicorns, and a unicorn being a company valued at over $1 billion. So, yeah, just kind of an example of that.
A lot of work and research, Charmaine, seems to have been done about this question in the United States, but not in the United Kingdom. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think that it's a relatively new space here. I think that Europe and the UK are a lot more rigid in the way that they do stuff, in the way they fund opportunities. There's so few senior partners that are from ethnic minority backgrounds to be able to have a voice enough. So, you know, you have to be in a position to be able to say, actually, I'm going to call you out. And you have to feel psychologically safe in order to do that. So if you're a token person that's been recruited as a VC member, especially where, you know, diversity is such a hot topic, sometimes people recruit just for the sake of it and don't actually give people real powers in the process. And if that's the case, then that makes it a lot more difficult to kind of to inch your way to having a real conversation.
Marianne, what happens when you go to pitch for money? What sort of response do you get?
So, I mean, I'm quite early in my process, so I've only experienced it a couple of times. But I think often you're asked, you know, quite intense questions. And I feel like you're...
What sort of intense questions?
You might be grilled a bit more on, like, your business model and, you know the general things that you're supposed to be asked, but probably just a little bit harsher with some undertones or microaggressions in the questions. Like, how do you feel you could build a team? Which really means, okay, will people listen to you? Or will you be able to command a group of people who aren't also black women? And I think that's a really touchy point, that there is this structural bias that people have before you've even opened your mouth, as soon as you've entered a room. And they use that to kind of judge how hard they're going to be on you. They kind of see you as much more of a risk because they're not familiar with you. So that definitely controls the narrative in terms of how they question you or get you to pitch.
Charmaine, from what you've written, there are very few black women in senior positions in the venture capital area. Why?
Well, there's a number of great reasons. I guess typically the VC network comes from an old boys club that started with Harvard graduates. When it came to the UK, it would be kind of largely like Oxford, Cambridge graduates, in which that they're, you know, if you're not like a fellow graduate there, which the likelihood is kind of minimal of someone from that background. And then people just generally aren't willing to give opportunities. And then, you know, when raising funding, because obviously a VC has to raise funding also, it's very likely that they're going to, if they're a senior partner and they want to raise a fund to distribute, that they're going to face difficulties, because generally VCs start with family money. So they'll be like from a rich family or have rich friends and friends in their network who contribute towards their first fund to be able to build a track record. If you don't come from that background, then going to institutional investors and saying, hey, we need money to be able to invest in people so that we can increase diversity, you're likely to kind of meet a lot of hurdles if you don't have that initial funding.
So what are the consequences for women like Miriam of facing these kind of barriers? What happens to their business idea?
Well, it's usually pushed to the side. People usually invest in people that look like them, with problems that they understand, that are, you know, if it affects their immediate circles. And someone like Marianne going across that, even if she does come across a black woman who's in VC or, you know, who kind of understands the problem, she's going to have the black tax, which is just where what we call the black tax, a situation where someone actually might feel like, you know what, it's a bigger risk for me because I don't feel psychologically safe to make these grand decisions. People are going to judge me if I invest in another black person because they think that I'm just doing it as a favour and I haven't really done proper due diligence. Well, and that's a problem also.
Charmaine Hayden and Mariam Jima, the very best of luck. Keep plugging away. I'm sure it'll happen. Thank you both very much indeed for being with us this morning. Now, you may well know Tom Kerridge from the television. You may have eaten in one of his Michelin-starred restaurants. You're almost certain to know he once weighed 30 stones and he lost 12 of them by changing his lifestyle. Well, he's now published a cookery book called Fresh Start, How to Cook Amazing Food at Home. And today we'll cook the perfect roasted winter sprout curry. Now, Tom, I have to say, I thought, winter sprouts? Really? How are you going to make these sprouts utterly delicious?
We're going to turn them into a curry. I mean, that's what we're going to do. I mean, if you think about, you know, if you think of the effects of sprouts, what could make them even more fun is turning them into a curry. That's what I thought of doing here. We're making sprouts fun. I mean, for me, sprouts are amazing, and they do seem to have this Marmite effect on people. But the reality, they're just tiny cabbages, and cooked well, they taste fantastic.
All right, so how do we cook them well? How do we make this dish?
So the first thing we've got is sprouts that have been marinated in ground turmeric and some ground coriander, okay? So they've kind of like sat there and just absorbed all those lovely spices and flavours. I'm going to stick them into a pan on this amazing... It's an amazing stove you've got in here.
I know. It's famous.
Yeah. And we're going to start cooking them through. And basically, they're not blanched. So what, a lot of the problem that you have with sprouts quite often is the fact that they're seen as being, they get boiled, okay? So people boil them in salted water and they get cooked for so long that you know, they lose all that texture and crust. If you kind of look at stir-frying them and cooking them and making them feel that it keeps some freshness and vibrancy about them, that's where they start tasting amazing. Okay, so the sprouts are in the pan, and then in a separate pan, I've got some onions that I've sliced and caramelised, and they're going to be cooked out. So the beautiful thing about onions is they've got this lovely, amazing texture and flavour that comes from it. They have a natural sweetness. They've got these lovely natural sugars in them. So as you cook them and you caramelise them more, all of those flavours are drawn out.
OK. Now, I know there are lots of other things that have to go in, but whilst you carry on cooking it, why fresh start cooking at home? Why was that really important to you?
So for me, I've gone through this period. So I've written the last two cookbooks before that have been about weight loss. The first one, The Dopamine Diet, was about it being a low carbohydrate diet. And it was my own personal journey because, I mean, people had seen I'd been on television and I'd done bits and bobs. But I'd made a decision when I was approaching my 40th birthday. You know, things, you know, once you get a little bit older and there's certain points in your life. And I think when you're in your 20s and 30s, you don't really recognize it or realize it, but I think as you get older and when there's certain, you know, there's a measurement of things, and it hit me that okay, I'm getting to 40, and it's a point in your life, it's a point of reflection where you start going, okay, so I've achieved whatever I've done in those last 40 years. Am I quite happy where I'm at? Where am I going to be in the next 40 years? And I think that was the point where I thought, actually, do you know what the reality is? If I keep going the way I'm going, I'm not going to be around for another 40 years.
How so, were you going? I mean, what was your lifestyle before you made this change?
Party. It was party. It was fun. It was like a constant drive of highs and buzzes of like, I love cooking and service and being a chef, and everything about a chef is, you know, I love the lifestyle of it. And it's very left field. It's quite rock and roll. It's late nights. It's early mornings. You live a life as a chef. You know, the one thing that you do is you kind of pretty much give up on sleep because you're too busy working, playing hard, having like really enjoying the whole connection with the hospitality industry and knowing,
you know, to get so big, as big as you did, you must have been consuming all the wrong things. I suspect beer had
a huge amount. Yeah, beer was massive, and beer was a huge part of my life. Alcohol was huge, and I've touched on it a number of times before. And it was one of those things where you finish service and you need that acceleration, that buzz, that thing. You don't just stop at 11:30 midnight and go home to bed. Then you need to be. So alcohol became quite a huge part of my life, and volume. I loved volume and just consumption. Everything about everything for me was just always about trying to get as much in as possible.
We were talking earlier to Sam about the eating disorder that he suffered from when he was a boy, which of course was anorexia. How would you describe what you were going through? Was there some sort of eating disorder in what you were doing?
Yeah, although it wasn't necessarily about food, it was about a release and a concern. I think when there's issues regarding alcohol was a big thing. Now there is an alcohol problem. I'm teetotal. I haven't touched alcohol now for just over five, nearly 6 years. So it's one of those that became an issue, and the eating became it. It wasn't any, I mean, that became just eating the wrong things at the wrong time of night, and just all about a carefree attitude, completely no respect for what I was eating or what it was doing for my body, just wanting to consume. But the mentality of it, the mental state of it, was one that is also, it's one that I don't regret, but it's one that I can't get back to, because it's a release of an energy of, you run a business and the pressures that you're under, of cooking to a level of two Michelin stars and running the business and people's lives, and there's always needs to be a release. So for me, it was trying to make sure that that was always something, the mental state of what I was doing was huge.
The sprouts and onions are smelling lovely.
Good.
Need I worry about them? Are they all right?
You don't need to worry about them. I'm just making sure that they're getting hot enough on
the famous cooker.
It's a very famous cooker. I love it. I may well take it home afterwards.
How are you dealing with the change? Because massive weight loss is often really hard to sustain.
Yeah, so... It is if you're viewing being on a diet as a diet. So if you view it as... So what happens with diets is diet has been thrown out there as a term, as a word that people see as depressing and boring, and that is it means you're trying to lose weight. However, diet is actually just the way that you eat, not necessarily about losing weight. So if you change the way that you eat or your outlook to life or what you do and have... and take a massive interest, and you concentrate, and as well, it's so much about the mental shift in how you view food, and you look at it as a balance, and you go, actually, what I want to do is make sure that food becomes, you concentrate on the food that you can eat, and how you enjoy eating, and how you can cook at home, how you can encourage kids to eat, how you can encourage, your whole lifestyle becomes very, very different. So the maintenance of it, it can't be short term. So you have to choose a way of eating or a lifestyle that you can see is sustainable forever.
Now, you did your television series on The Fresh Start with families learning to cook, both the adults and the children. But how easy, when they go away, is it for them day to day to find the time to cook and avoid the convenience foods?
So the reality, I mean, that's the one thing that everybody talks about is time and being time poor and time short. And however, it's about priority and finding priorities. And a lot of that is, you know, you can batch cook stuff and put it in freezers. You can find very quick and easy recipes to do. You can also, like, if your time is you'd rather sit down for half an hour and watch a soap opera, well, actually, that half an hour, you can cook yourself, you know, you can cook yourself something, which is the most important. Hey, we've all got BBC iPlayer now. You can catch the soap. You can catch EastEnders later. You haven't got to watch it at the time that it's on. You know, you can. It's about prioritising what you do and how you view your life. And I tell you what, with the show, the most amazing thing for me was the journey of the show was fantastic over the 12 weeks. But actually how that lifestyle change had happened to so many families that we took on that journey, that was so encouraging. The mental state of everyone was so much happier. Everyone was enjoying the food that they were doing. And the beautiful thing, I suppose, is encouraging kids to be a part of it, is that self-responsibility is then it's not just about you, it's about your life and your family. And that was really good in the maintenance of it.
Now listen, we've got to get the cereal on shortly, and so you're going to finish that and I'm going to have it for my lunch, I hope.
Yeah.
Just one more question. You made a bizarre revelation which people were really surprised about: tinfoil. What is the tinfoil story?
Well, like that, right? That sent Twitter into meltdown,
and
it was bananas, right? And there was stories in the Mail and the Express, and it was like, I mean, literally, there's two sides to tinfoil. There's a shiny side and a dull side. And as a chef, and for me, I'd always been taught that the shiny side you put on top of the food when you put it into the oven because it's reflective. So as heat comes up, it reflects the heat back better. Now, that's all, there's two sides. That for me, I'll go, that's how it works, okay? And then there were loads of people go, God, yeah, of course, that makes complete sense. That's it. And then I had like mental nutcases going at me, going, no, it's completely, it doesn't matter what it, like, the world went crazy over two sides of tinfoil. However, I still cook with the shiny side down because it just makes complete sense to me.
And if Tom Kerridge's cooks with the shiny side down, we will all cook with the shiny side down. And I have a mouthful, I'm afraid, of the perfect roasted winter sprout curry. Just quickly, Tom, tell me what else went in it. There are lots of seeds. It's absolutely gorgeous, by the way.
caraway seeds, cumin seeds, there's turmeric in there, there's the coriander, the spicing that goes with it, but it's not too hot. So there's a bit of green chili that's gone into that, but it's all about the flavour. So it's trying to drive, make sprouts not necessarily taste like sprouts, trying to encourage them. Texturally, they're still crunchy, they're crisp, they taste delicious. And then you've got the soft paneer cheese mixed with it and the caramelisation of the onions and just all mixed together with a little bit of veg stock. It's very simple. But it does taste lovely.
Could you come and cook for us every day?
I tell you what, if you get a new cooker, I'll definitely be here. Yeah.
And I was talking to Tom Kerridge. Now, we had lots of response to the eating disorder question. This one said, my son started to have anorexia in his mid-20s, so not a boy but a man, and was much better at 29. I don't think he'll ever not have some problems with food. It is a disease that can kill. His weight dropped so low that he had many problems associated with malnutrition, as many body functions closed down, and he had mental health problems because his mind also didn't work very well. He had good support in Cornwall, but he thinks he recovered through mindfulness and taking control of his own recovery. Like many people, the anorexia may have been associated with his need for control, especially after a series of difficult circumstances. I have not asked his permission to write this, so please don't use my name. And then a tweet, we are 5 months into the battle with anorexia with a 16-year-old son. Devastating, consuming and exhausted. We're not giving up and live in hope that he will recover. Facebook support page has been a lifesaver for me as his mum, who is a full-time caring mother at the moment. And then we came to Tom Kerridge and the sprout curry and the conversation about tinfoil. And Lawrence Brown said, how can anyone argue with Tom Kerridge? It makes perfect sense, and I have tested this theory. Half shiny and dull on the same dish, and although there is no noticeable cooking difference, there is a different browning outcome, with the shiny side down giving a much better result. And John Moore said, love Tom's cooking. Can you ask him why they can't make tinfoil shiny both sides? Then it won't matter. Now do join me if you can for tomorrow's programme when I'll be talking to the author Maggie G. She joins me to talk about her latest novel, which is called Blood. It's an exploration of some of the darker human emotions in a literary comedy with dashes of thriller, elements of farce, criminal caper and political satire. So join me tomorrow, 10:02 for today. Bye-bye.
Did you know that technology can make us kinder to one another? Did you hear about the diver who walked out of the sea onto a Portuguese beach, dragging the internet behind him? Did you realize that how you speak to the little robot helper in your house might cement age-old stereotypes for decades to come? I'm Alex Krotowski, and those are just some of the stories that we've looked at in The Digital Human, the podcast that explores what it means to be human in the digital age. If you want to hear more, and I guarantee we will surprise you, come check us out exclusively on BBC Sounds.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the hosts of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following, to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.